This paid program may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour, a conversation about management with a government executive who is changing the way government does business. The Business of Government Hour is produced by the IBM Center for the Business of Government, which was created in 1998 to encourage discussion and research into new approaches to improving government effectiveness. You can find out more about the center by visiting us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. And now, the Business of Government Hour.
Welcome to a special edition of the Business of Government Hour, Leaders Speak, a conversation on changing the way government does business. I'm Michael Keegan, your host and managing editor of the Business of Government magazine. Since its creation in 1998, the IBM Center for the Business of Government has sought to connect public management research to practice, and in turn, practitioners to researchers. We do this in a variety of ways. This show, the Business of Government Hour, is just one way we make this happen. Each week, I bring you leading government executives who are changing the way government does business. They share their in-depth reflections on the work they do and the efforts they lead. Our guests join us for an informative, insightful, and in-depth conversation, which highlights the progress being made in public management and the leaders who bring it about. Over the last 5 years, we've interviewed more than 250 government executives from the federal, state, and local levels. It is from this rich library that we've culled together their insights on topics important to you. This week, Leaders Speak brings you past and current government leaders and their insights on how government is changing the way it does business. Whenever possible, I also introduce the insights from authors of IBM Center reports. It is within this context that I've assembled a varied group of government executives and thought leaders for this special edition of the Business of Government Hour. In an era of fiscal contraction, today's government leaders face unique challenges that present many difficult choices. It is a period that, while imposing constraints, simultaneously confers as many opportunities. These are the opportunities to introduce new ways of doing business, explore pragmatic approaches, and pursue management imperatives that help government leaders perform in an ever-challenging and complex environment. Gene Dodaro, Comptroller General of the United States, identifies a variety of trends that illustrate this complex environment. It is a prelude to the challenges facing government executives that has prompted them to change the way they do business.
And we spent a lot of time making sure that we understand the trends because we believe they will shape the types of challenges federal government will face and the decisions that policymakers might have. First, there are national security threats. They've obviously become more diffuse and evolving. These are areas ranging from regional instability to extremism, terrorism, proliferation of nuclear weapons, cyber terrorism. These are all things that are very important, and they're also emerging challenges and threats that can be caused by changing economic conditions, even climate change, energy independence issues. So it's very important for the work that we do. So that's sort of trend number one, are these broad trends and changing security threats. Second are the fiscal sustainability challenges. The federal government faces enormous challenges in this regard to make sure that we can put the federal government on a more sustainable long-term fiscal path. This is dominating a lot of the discussion now in the Congress. But we also look at the state and local sector as well, and they face many of the same challenges. Third are economic recovery and growth. Obviously, we're dealing still with the aftermath of the last recession. Unemployment's high. Housing market is still weak. You know, we monitor the banking sector and other sectors of the economy as well and look at the federal government's activities to provide training assistance and others. Global interdependence is the fourth trend, and this is very important not only for flows of capital, which receives a lot of attention, but also other areas of trade and products that are really changing how the federal government needs to protect the public. In food safety, for example, medical devices and drugs. The next trend, science and technology, obviously a lot of changes, nanotechnology, cloud computing. a lot of areas that are potential solutions to help both from an economic growth standpoint in our country, but also the effective and productivity of government and the private sector. But they have a lot of issues that need to be dealt with. For example, you know, cloud computing can be very helpful in driving down costs, but there are also security issues that need to be dealt with the federal government. Another trend is networks and virtualization. You know, obviously, how we learn, communicate, and deal with one another is changing dramatically across the world, and it's from mobile devices, wireless technologies, and et cetera. And this involves looking and shaping how the federal government's adapting to those changes, both from a regulatory standpoint and broadband technologies, allocation of spectrum, for example, but also how the federal government's using these devices to improve its own performance in dealing with the public. And also the last trend is demographic and social changes. Very important to understand because they have important policy ramifications for the government.
Many of the trends described by Comptroller General Gene Dodaro challenge the way government does business, and how government executives respond matters most. Danny Warfel, Comptroller, Office of Federal Financial Management within OMB, highlights the specific challenges facing most government executives today.
Well, let me start with the most obvious challenge that I think anyone sitting in a government leadership position is looking at right now, and that is the declining resource environment that we find ourselves in. It is no surprise that the budget cuts that we're facing impact all parts of government, and chief financial officers are no different. And so you have this dual-edged challenge of trying to modernize and make government more efficient. And you know, we say a lot, it's never been more critical for us to do so because of the challenging budgetary situation that we find ourselves in. The number one challenge that I have right now is working with federal agencies to define those steps that they can take and those investments that they can make that are going to have the highest impact and that are going to be the most shrewd, for lack of a better term, in managing this tension. The second one that I would articulate is, in order to navigate the tension that I just described of a lower resource base and a need, a necessity to become more efficient, we've got to break old habits and we've got to innovate to do so. So the example I'll use is with respect to information technology. And we have an approach that we've taken to modernize business systems in government over the last decade. And the approach has proven to be slow and expensive. We have to do them more quickly and get more critical performance out of them. And the third issue, and it's very related to the other two, is what I call creating a culture of collaboration. If one agency has a success, how do we create an environment that other agencies are obsessed with what that success was, how was it achieved, and how can I learn about how that success might impact my area? Or a failure. What happened? What went wrong?
So how is government changing the way it does business? Danny Warfel offers a glimpse explaining the work he is doing to meet many of these challenges head on.
Well, the way I think about the work that we're doing, I put it into two different buckets of activities. It's either about cutting waste or it's about building a government for the 21st century. We have this initiative we call the Campaign to Cut Waste. It was launched by the president through an executive order last spring in June, put the vice president in charge of it, which, you know, relates back to I've had several opportunities to work with the vice president directly, first on the Recovery Act, now on the Campaign to Cut Waste, and the whole vice president's team, who are fantastic to work with. We have a whole variety of different things we're trying to achieve under the Campaign to Cut Waste. We are cutting administrative savings, things like IT, printing, and travel, vehicles or fleet. You know, this is kind of the bread and butter stuff that won't necessarily, you know, eliminate our deficit by any stretch, but represent two things. First, they represent dollars, and every dollar counts. I'm the most frugal guy I know. So if I hear about an agency that involved in something where $5,000 was wasted, or $5 million, or $50 million, I'm upset. in either way. You know, I every dollar counts, and these are practical things that can be done. We don't have to get rid of an automobile. That's fine just because we're interested in the next upgrade. We can hold on to our vehicles longer. You know, we don't need a printer on every desk. We don't need to travel just for the sake of travel without a critical purpose for that travel. We issued that 20% cut requirement back in November of 2011. And then we put in the president's budget all the agency's commitments on that 20% cut. And it totaled $8 billion. And then within the campaign to cut waste, there's other things. There's improper payments. There's managing our real estate more effectively. And I'd say on the 21st century government, there's a lot going on. But to pick a top priority, I'd pick how are we going to move forward in open government and transparency. And in particular, where I have the most responsibility and where I lose the most sleep at night is how are we making federal spending more transparent? All of those things are part of a strategic set of priorities that I'm working on with the financial management community.
For federal agencies to be successful requires support and assistance. GSA's Office of Citizen Services and Innovative Technologies has positioned itself as the government-wide leader in identifying and fostering the adoption of new and innovative technologies, fostering new ways of doing business. Here's Kathy Conrad, its Principal Deputy Associate Administrator.
Well, we have a very lean but incredibly productive office, about 100 super talented, hardworking people, plus a team of excellent contractors, and a budget of about $35 million, pretty small. But we're a little spark plug, igniting innovation all across government through two primary organizations, the Office of Citizen Services and the Office of Innovative Technologies. The Office of Citizen Services provides consumer information and services to the public wherever, whenever, and using whatever device or communication channel they choose. The Office of Innovative Technology identifies and fosters innovative technologies that help agencies increase efficiency, enhance effectiveness of services to citizens, and achieve cost savings. So most of our programs are divided into those two offices. We've got, as I said, the Federal Citizen Information Center, which runs USA.gov, Gobierno.gov, Kids.gov, the National Contact Center, and PublicationsUSA.gov. We have the Center for Excellence in Digital Government, which runs our Challenges program, which you're familiar with, mm-hmm. and supports the Federal Web Managers Council. We have a mobile PMO, which has more recently been combined with our Digital Services Innovation Center. And then in the innovative technology arena, we have the Federal Cloud Computing PMO, our FedRAMP program, Federal Data Center Consolidation Program, and data.gov, along with a few others.
Conrad's office plays a lead role in pursuing a cloud-first policy to save money and improve performance.
It's forcing agencies to consider whether there are better, more agile ways to use scarce IT resources to enable achievement of desired program and mission outcomes. It's important to remember cloud computing is not about the technology. It's about mission enablement. So what is it? Lots of different definitions, but I think the best way to think about it is as a utility, where you buy the services you need to meet real-time demands. Cloud solutions offer infrastructure as a service solutions like servers and storage that can be used to host websites and meet other requirements, software as a service for applications such as email, or platform as a service which can be used for testing and development, other requirements.
Kathy Conrad identifies at least three benefits to pursuing a cloud-first solution.
In terms of benefits, there are really three key benefits. First, it's cheaper. Services are automatically delivered and consumed as they're used, which means you only pay for what you actually use. Agencies can shift from owning and maintaining costly physical assets to managing service delivery, reducing the need for ongoing capital expenditures. And cost savings are also achieved from aggregated demand. If you can aggregate demand across an entire enterprise, you benefit from economies of scale and save significant funds over the long term. Second, it's actually better in terms of performance. On-demand services enable flexible, rapid response to dynamic business needs. So you know that as your needs change, you can get the services that you actually need. And it's faster. You can provision services rapidly and automatically, dramatically decreasing time to deploy or implement solutions. So it's better, faster, and cheaper. Seems like a pretty good deal.
Cloud computing is just one way government is changing the way it does business. What are some of the other ways government is changing the way it does business? We will explore this question and so much more when this special edition of Business of Government Hour returns. Is there a recipe for successful cross-agency collaborations that are enduring? Or is each initiative so dependent on context and personality that there's no way to offer general principles of success? Well, an IBM Center report by Dr. Jane Fountain, Implementing Cross-Agency Collaborations, a Guide for Federal Managers, offers advice on successful cross-agency relationships. Fountain says there's, in fact, a recipe for success, but it depends on the number of factors. Go to businessofgovernment.org, download Jane Fountain's report, and find out. That's businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to a special edition of the Business of Government Hour, Leaders Speak, a conversation on changing the way government does business. Richard Boley, Director of the Office of E-Diplomacy within the Bureau of Information Resource Management at the U.S. Department of State, is charged with making e-diplomacy the way to collaborate within the department.
So really the nub of e-diplomacy is to make sure that if somebody has the information that another person needs to get their work done, that they can find each other. It's not this hierarchical command and control knowledge management approach where there's some gigantic data basement somewhere where everything needs to be thrown and you go fishing for the information there. It's more that information is where it is and you just need it to make it discoverable. To facilitate access to the information that a diplomat or our State Department employees need anytime, anywhere on any of our available platforms. And so that's kind of the real nub of it. But part of it is, although I don't like the idea of cultural change, there is a change implicit in this. If you move from a Cold War need-to-know approach where, you know, the idea, the watchword was keep information locked down, siloed, because the big bad Soviet bear was out there trying to get pieces and aggregate them to figure out our secrets. And you fast forward to the post-9/11 era where we found ourselves crippled by our inability to aggregate those same pieces of information to identify our threats and vulnerabilities. So that sea change, that change from need to know to need to share, is fundamental to what we do. Equally fundamental is the idea that success is not dependent on the information you hoard, but the ability to articulate the information you have across an important, valuable network throughout the enterprise, not just to the people you know, but people who may be a degree or two of separation away from you, but would benefit from having access to the information you have.
According to Boley, it's about identifying better ways to find and share information, to network, thus enabling and encouraging State Department personnel to securely and effectively contribute knowledge anywhere, anytime.
Out of that was born e-diplomacy, which was an effort to put end users in the IT decision-making process and help us develop platforms for collaboration and information sharing really from the grassroots.
Richard Boley describes how promoting internal agency information sharing enhances performance and directly transforms how the U.S. Department of State does business. But the importance of information sharing across all government agencies cannot be overstated. It is critical to the safety and security of this country that federal, state, local, private sector, and international partners improve their sharing of information about terrorism, homeland security, and weapons of mass destruction. When examining the full scope of information sharing and protection, many widespread and complex challenges must be addressed and solved by multiple agencies and organizations working together. That's why pursuing the goals of the Information Sharing Environment, ISE, is so critical to changing how government agencies share information. Smendra Paul, the ISE program manager, explains.
The ISE is a complicated topic. The way I think about it is that the ISE is a collection of normalized mission and technical capabilities distributed and decentralized across all of our mission partners, federal, state, local, tribal, and private sector entities. The ISE is delivered by interconnecting existing networks, systems, and databases, working with industry and standards bodies to adopt required standards and other frameworks. The ISE harmonizes and standardizes information processes based on shared mission equities. And finally, the ISE strengthens information safeguarding, including protecting privacy, civil liberties, and civil rights of the American people. A practical way of thinking about the ISE is to think of it as an information analog to the interstate highway system. The same way the interstate highway system knit together this country post-World War II, the ISE is intended to be the information fabric enabling whole-of-government responses to national security and public safety challenges that face our nation.
So how is ISE changing the way information is shared across government agencies?
Spender Paul continues.
The number one issue is 11 years post 9/11, retaining the urgency and prioritization of accelerating responsible information sharing. That's the our number one challenge. We've had a lot of progress. We've made progress. Last year, at the 10-year anniversary, commentators inside, outside the government all recognized the progress we've made on information sharing post 9/11. But there's more work to do, and it requires focus and prioritization. The number two challenge is new, and it's just as big as the structural financial challenge faced by agencies in the public sector. It's bad at the federal level. It's much worse at the state and local level. Number three is the evolving and increasingly integrated threats that span national security and public safety missions. And four is the tsunami of information and the imperative to correlate disparate bits of information across the distributed ISE.
Improving mission performance is key to changing the way government does business. Dr. Peter L. Levin, former Chief Technology Officer at the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs, tells us about the success of VA's Blue Button Initiative.
This is a project that was actually spearheaded by Jan Kemp and by Sonia Batten, two people who I consider sort of my closest collaborators at VA. Now, suicide, as you might know, is an endemic problem in the United States right now, right? It's not particular to veterans. But when veterans have this problem, it's something that we can do something about as long as they're in our system, as long as we can touch them, as we know who they are, they have to identify themselves. Jan had this idea to create a chat service. And she said, well, look, we have this capability. The technology is there. It's not very expensive and it's highly secure. But she was being blocked, you know, by the bureaucracy and by the qualifications and the certifications. So the first project that I worked on, literally in the first month, I can tell you the day that we went live. It was July 3rd, 2009. And we turned on that internet chat service. And fast forward to today, we have over 6,000 interventions, right? Now, that's, I'm not talking about just the chats that we have every time somebody, you know, misdialed us or, you know, they weren't, let me say, weren't looking for suicide prevention services. They were looking for something else. But nothing is more important to me than those couple of folks that are with their families today because of what Jan did a couple of years ago and where I got to kind of help push it across the goal line a little bit.
Taking care of our veterans is a critical commitment, but only half the battle. With rising health care costs and increased number of beneficiaries, the focus on value and innovation are key. Vice Admiral Matthew Nathan, Surgeon General of the U.S. Navy, tells us more about his efforts to realize sustained value while keeping a healthy and fit force, and how the advent of virtual medicine and the Medical Home Port Program fits into how the Navy and all the armed forces are changing the way they deliver health care services.
So we've created Patient-Centered Medical Home, which is a pod of providers centered around a physician, a nurse practitioner, a physician's assistant, perhaps an advanced duty corpsman, all of them who know you. Mm-hmm. One of them is available to you where this is working. We don't have it everywhere yet, but it's growing. But where it's working, you can reach one of them at all times. In addition, you communicate to them majority of the time through either a web-based, secure web-based system or through email or through an iPhone or whatever. You don't have to come in for everything. Harnessing the power of digital and telemedicine is critical. And I would add pivotal to the United States Navy because I need that more than any place else because I have so many medical facilities displaced all over the world. I can provide the firepower, the medical firepower of a tertiary care hospital to a small little ship that's out in the middle of the ocean. So already we're leveraging what I call virtual medicine, telemedicine. And I believe that, A, that's good for people in austere environments, and B, that's going to be the game changer for cost.
How is the U.S. Department of Defense changing the way it does business? We will explore this question and so much more when the special edition of the Business of Government Hour returns. Pundits warn about the fiscal cliff, but federal agencies nearly every year hold up the budgetary sky while walking on the edge of a cliff. It's called the world of continuing resolutions and potential government shutdowns. The IBM Center report, The Cost of Budgetary Uncertainty, Analyzing the Impact of Late Appropriations by Dr. Phil Joyce, examines the impact of late budgets on the efficiency and effectiveness of government operations. To find out more about the cost of budgetary uncertainty, go to businessofgovernment.org. That's businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to a special edition of the Business of Government Hour, Leaders Speak, a conversation on changing the way government does business. The U.S. Department of Defense is one of the largest and most complex organizations in the world. managing a budget more than twice that of the world's largest corporation, and overseeing millions of personnel operating worldwide. Given the size and complexity of the department's finances and operations, along with the rapid pace of change, engagement in major military campaigns, and worldwide economic uncertainty, it is imperative that DoD create an agile, responsive, and efficient operation. In this segment, we present the perspectives of two key DoD leaders directly involved in changing the way the U.S. Department of Defense does its business, both bringing an exacting combination of practical knowledge and an understanding of the work to be done and the progress already achieved. First up, Bob Hale, Undersecretary of Defense and Controller, on the complexity of managing the U.S. Department of Defense.
I'll go with the facts first. This year, we will execute about $688 billion worth of budget authority of the taxpayers' money to maintain our national security. So we obligate $2 to $3 billion a day on average. It's a very sizable amount. In terms of the specific things that I do, as I mentioned, we spend a lot of time formulating budgets. It's our way of putting together our priorities. Also need to put them together in a way that can convince the Congress and the public that we both need the resources and will spend them appropriately to maintain national security. And then we have a responsibility to make sure that we execute those budgets in a manner that's legal. And there are 8,000 pages in the DoD Financial Management Regulations, so there are lots of laws and regulations. That's effective, that we meet the needs of our warfighters. And finally, it's efficient, for the sake of the taxpayers, and maybe particularly in these days, efficiency is very much on our minds.
As achieving efficiencies is very much on the mind of Undersecretary Hale, so are many of the challenges he faces managing the resources of the U.S. Department of Defense.
Well, certainly a key challenge is to make sure that we acquire the resources that we need to meet national security objectives and do that when we're dealing with a nation that is in an economic crisis. I think a key challenge is striking that right balance, getting the resources we need, but understanding that we need to make every dollar count in order to hold down the deficit. Once we get the resources, we need to execute them, as I've said, in a manner that's effective. I think we do that pretty well. A bigger challenge, though, is how well we do at documenting how we've spent the money and presenting that information to the public. And in particular, we are one of the two federal agencies that has never had a clean opinion, accounting opinion on or audit opinion on its financial statements. And that's something we need to change. The last one I'll mention is championing, working for a strong financial management workforce. We need to have those 68,000 people well-trained, and I think they generally are. So I'd say that the budget job, certainly a major challenge, auditability, a major challenge, working to maintain a strong workforce, also a challenge.
Auditability is a major challenge for DoD. Undersecretary Hale outlines DoD's financial improvement and audit readiness strategy in changing the way it does business.
Let me start by saying I believe the Department of Defense has reasonable controls over its budgets. There are some of our critics who assert the contrary. I think they're wrong. As evidence of that, I'd just note quickly that we have 3,000 auditors who are watching our program and financial moves, and yet we have quite high levels of compliance with key financial legislation, quite high levels of proper payments. But we do need to achieve auditable financial statements for a variety of reasons. They'll help us clean up some imperfections that we may talk about more in our business processes. But most importantly, they'll reassure the public that we're reasonable stewards of their money. And in terms, when I came into this job, there had been progress made, no question. But I think I quickly realized the department wasn't heading in a single direction. Services were doing different things. Some were doing more, some less, no common purpose. We were sometimes trying to do things where there wasn't much management commitment to doing it. So we formulated, I call it the focused approach. It basically pretty simple. It says, let's put our highest priorities on improving information and achieving audit readiness for the kinds of information we most use to manage the Pentagon. And that's first and foremost budgetary information, because we manage the department based on budgets. And second, where our assets are and how many we have, which is very important to warfighters. Auditors call it existence and completeness. So we have focused our attention on trying to improve information in for those categories and move toward audit readiness.
Given DoD's scale of operation, Bob Hale highlights some of the major challenges and obstacles facing the department in its efforts to improve financial information and audit readiness.
You've stated one of them in the question, which is our size and our geographical dispersion. What they mean is that we can't go hire an army of accountants, or it would be such a large army that we could never afford it, and do all this work manually. And that brings me to two other major challenges or impediments, if you will, that we face. First, our systems, our financial systems, many of them are old. Some of them date back to the 70s and 80s, and they aren't designed to do what auditors expect. They're designed to keep track of budgets. They're not designed to accommodate audits. When an auditor pulls a sample of thousands of payments spread all around the world, we have to go chase down the paper, and it's a task that you can't do quickly, and it's very expensive. The new systems that we're putting in will keep this information in an automated fashion, so works well. We'll push a button, and when an auditor asks for it, it will be there. So we need new financial systems. The other thing we need are to improve our business processes. Well, I think we have reasonable controls. Our business processes are variable across our commands, sometimes from base to base. They may be effective, but in some cases, they're simply not something an auditor would accept. The auditors want to see more detail where we put it, and so we're going to have to change that business practice in order to move toward auditability. So there are some major challenges that we've got to overcome. We're on our way, but it's going to be a lengthy journey.
Although the road to achieve auditability at DoD is lengthy and arduous, Undersecretary Hale points to some of the key successors to date.
Well, we have made some progress. The Army Corps of Engineers, which is actually not part of the DoD budget but still affiliated with the military, has fully auditable financial statements and is maintaining them, has for several years. Several of our large defense agencies have had auditable statements for sometimes more than a decade and have maintained them, the Defense Finance and Accounting Service, Defense Contract Audit Agency, Defense Commissary Agency, and some others. And some of our trust funds, we maintain some very large trust funds for military retirement and military health care, also have positive audit opinions. What we haven't done yet is achieve that goal for any of the military services, and that is by far the highest hurdle to leap. They are much more complex. They're bigger than anything we have gone after yet. But we have, for the first time ever, a statement of a military service, in this case the United States Marine Corps, under audit, their statement of budgetary resources. And I'm cautiously optimistic that we'll see a positive opinion this year, more optimistic that we'll make it by next year. So we're moving into what I might call the big boy issues of auditability in terms of actually working on the military services. And we just have to go after them before we're ever going to get close.
Working closely with Undersecretary Hale to achieve meaningful improvements within DoD is Beth McGrath, its Deputy Chief Management Officer. Beth highlights her role and the role of her fairly young office in changing the way DoD does business.
So in 2005, we established the Business Management Modernization Program to look more holistically across the business enterprise and not just focus on the financials. And there, too, Congress recognized that we needed some more tools in our toolbox, if you will, to really go after the entire business space. So it is around that time that Congress legislated to us the utilization of a business enterprise architecture, enterprise transition plan, more effective governance, really the tools that most corporations have as they manage their overall operation. The Deputy Chief Management Officer position was established in the 2009 National Defense Authorization Act, and it was there that they created both the position of the Deputy Chief Management Officer and codified the role of the Deputy Secretary of Defense as the Chief Management Officer or Chief Operating Officer across the department. And that really elevated the conversation to be more holistic, not only within the OSD element, but also across the military departments. Because in that same legislation, they identified the undersecretaries of the military departments as the chief management officers for their respective components. So they really put the structure across the department, across all of the business lines, to effectively manage and oversee and integrate the entire business space.
Beth McGrath faces many challenges in her efforts to transform the business processes and operations of the U.S. Department of Defense.
I would say size creates a challenge, because to try and implement something across an enterprise that is as big as the 16th country in the world would be, that doesn't happen overnight, nor does it happen very easily. And so really it's coming up with a framework that can be executed, replicated, and implemented across the defense enterprise is absolutely probably my top two challenges if I was to was able to account the size for the first two. But I would also add complexity to that list. Many of our operations have started, and when I say operations, I don't mean from a military perspective. The way we conduct business is very, very different. We are very non-standard. Frankly, by design, we were that way. So if you put size and complexity together, one would wonder why I would want this job. But I do think it's terribly exciting, because it's also an opportunity to really make significant change in an enterprise that, you know, really wants to and can execute in just the most tremendous ways. Building this coalition for change across the department, articulating the importance of the business mission and how it really facilitates and empowers and enables our core national security mission, I think, is a tremendous opportunity. And so, you know, size and complexity, yes, we have both, but we also have some of the best, you know, people that, you know, I certainly have had the opportunity to work with. And it's really getting to those people to enable the change and establish the change agents across the whole Federation, if you will, is really the a very exciting part of what I do.
In meeting many of her challenges head-on, McGrath outlines the department's strategy for improving its critical business operations.
The business enterprise architecture, and the way I characterize the architecture is that I've talked a little bit about the holistic approach and this end-to-end focus that we have in the department. The architecture is the place you write it down. So if you made agreement on a business process or a standard in a specific area, you need a place to write it down that everybody knows, you know, it's going to be there. And so that is the blueprint, if you will, that drives the path ahead from a business perspective. So I mentioned that the BEA needs to align to a strategy for it to be purposeful and meaningful. The strategic management plan is the business strategic document. It's also aligned to the department's overarching strategic document, which is the Quadrennial Defense Review. And there's an overarching goal in the QDR that talks about, you know, implementing the reform agenda and really going after the business space. And that's where we hook, if you will, the SMP, Strategic Management Plan, to the overarching enterprise goals. The Enterprise Transition Plan is the document that says, well, here's where I am today and here's how I'm getting to the future state. And so that really is the document that says, here's where I am today, and this is the place I want to be, and then how we're going to get there and by when.
Focusing on DoD's core business missions is critical to changing the way it does business. Beth McGrath elaborates.
So the core business areas that we had previously defined, weapon systems, life cycle management, material supply and services, real property and infrastructure, financial management, and human resources. Those areas are very much aligned to the way DoD is organized. And we have really found that in order to drive business improvements or business operations, you really need to cut across the various functional areas. Those are all very functionally aligned, tied to an organization. And so we're really looking at, you know, what are the end-to-end processes that we really need to go after? There are 15 that are in the commercial space, and we have chosen two of them to put our main focus on, and they are hire to retire and procure to pay. And it's really taking a look at defining what the high-level end-to-end process looks like. What standards do you need? What changes do you need to make? And what systems do you have that are currently executing those processes? You'd be amazed what you find when you start mapping sort of systems to process. And then, you know, it is no secret that DoD has thousands of systems that are not interoperable. And so the goal here is to say, well, if I'm trying to execute an end-to-end process, which is what we do every day, then our systems system should be enablers to the execution of that process. And so it's, I'm going to say, not terribly exciting to some people to, you know, map systems to processes. But when you see really the opportunity to make things better and more seamless, it's really hard not to do something about it. And so really we are mapping and aligning and documenting the various processes and standards, because those are the things that make things go. I mean, we want it to be invisible to the operators out there. They don't need to know all about the procure to pay and hire to retire. At the end of the day, they just want their paycheck right, and they want it fast. They want the information reliable and accurate so that they can make decisions about, you know, do I have enough cash to buy this, or do I need to do something else? I mean, it's all about achieving business outcomes.
For McGrath, it's all about achieving business outcomes. Getting off the GAO high-risk list exemplifies her outcome-based approach.
So we spend a lot of time with our partners in the Government Accountability Office. DOD owns on its own 8 of the 30 and then shares another 7, which is how we get to we own half. In the personal security clearance area, again, it was very much focused not only on the DOD backlog and transaction time. It was focused on the federal space because there were issues across the federal government about the backlog and then the time it took to actually get a security clearance. And so it was really a partnership with the Office of Personnel Management, who is the main investigative service provider for the federal government, the Office of Management and Budget, and the management side, the Deputy Director for Management, and the Office of the Director for National Intelligence, the DNI. And it really took everyone to do their piece, both a policy, process, and information technology, to enable us to get off the high-risk list. And so Lean Six Sigma, that is where we started. We essentially locked everyone in a room and said, we need to relook at the process. And we did discover that there were changes that ought to be made in the federal investigative standards. And we had the people at the table, being the Office of Personnel Management and the Director of National Intelligence, because they own security policy from a federal perspective. So they are the policy owners, if you will. You know, step up and make changes to those federal investigative standards. And then we looked at the backlog, really put a lot of people on it in addition to IT, and we're able to take 100,000 case backlog for DOD down to zero. So that, to me, is a significant improvement. Our average security clearance time back then was 165 days. That was in 2006. And today it's roughly about 47 days. And so, I mean, that's tremendous.
As their perspectives indicate, Bob Hale and Beth McGrath have spearheaded a promising partnership between the CFO and DCMO communities with the U.S. Department of Defense. They are collaborators as well as leaders in making the Secretary's vision a reality. In the end, it's clear that their collective focus is on enhancing the department by making it more efficient, accountable, and strategic in its use of mission support resources, with the ultimate aim of providing the best possible support to the warfighter. How can analytics and risk management change the way government does business? We will explore this question and so much more when the special edition of the Business of Government Hour returns. How do leaders direct ambitious change and achieve significant goals? What strategies do they use to overcome opposition and win allies? And how do specific organizational and political contexts affect strategies and outcomes? These are important age-old questions. To help answer them, the IBM Center has released Forging Governmental Change by Professor Harry Lambright. Lambright has identified two premier government leaders, Dr. Robert Gates of DOD and Dr. Francis Collins of NIH, who have led transformations within their own organizations. By all accounts, both men have been effective leaders of change. This report continues the IBM Center's long interest in leadership and transformation. So go to businessofgovernment.org and download Forging Governmental Change, Lessons from Transformations Led by Robert Gates and Francis Collins. That's businessofgovernment.org. There you can download all Center reports and find out how the business of government is not business as usual. Welcome back to a special edition of the Business of Government Hour. Leaders Speak, a conversation on changing the way government does business. Whether it's getting big things done in government or changing the way government does business, we bring together thoughtful perspectives from a host of leading practitioners and academics in the field. This special edition of the Business of Government Hour, Leaders Speak, focuses on how analytics and risk management can, when employed at an enterprise level, assist government agencies in strengthening their decision-making capabilities and, in turn, improve their overall performance. First up, Tom Davenport, Distinguished Professor of Information Technology and Management at Babson College. Professor Davenport joined us for an in-depth conversation on analytics and its strategic importance.
Well, I really define analytics as systematic efforts to analyze data in a quantitative fashion. So that might be statistics, econometrics. Sometimes people get into textual analytics, particularly in the intelligence field. Anytime you use systematic analysis of data to help make a decision. And analytics is really a subset of business intelligence. So I usually think of business intelligence, that's the broad category in the information technology field for what you do with data to help understand how your organization is performing and kind of what's going on in your business. And it consists of two things. There's reporting, which is simplified reports or queries or dashboards or scorecards, but that's all about the past and it's all about what happened last quarter, last month, and it doesn't really tell you anything about why something happened, and it doesn't go forward into the future at all. Analytics are the other part of business intelligence that starts to give you an understanding of why something happened, which is always useful, and then once you have a model that predicts the past, you can start predicting the future, and that's incredibly useful. So analytics, I think, is a more valuable activity than reporting, but you kind of need reporting before you can really get into analytics much.
It's no secret that companies have for some time successfully analyzed data to gain a competitive edge. And now that competitive analytics and business intelligence techniques are mainstream, to what extent can governments use the techniques to enhance its overall performance and make better decisions?
While government organizations may not be competing on analytics, you're starting to see some evidence that they are transforming themselves, beginning to transform themselves through the use of analytics. You see it in certain sectors. Certainly, intelligence has often been about analytics, and they're heavy users of it and have been for a while. The big initiative there is how do we get different intelligence agencies in the United States to share all that data? Healthcare, huge issue right now. How do we use comparative effectiveness analytics to know which treatment is really most effective and most worth paying for? How do we use analytics to identify the patients who are most likely to contract diabetes, say? Big initiatives in healthcare. Taxes, I'm afraid, are another area where analytics are pretty heavily used to kind of identify the people who might be underpaying or not paying at all their taxes. And certainly in the military, there have always been a lot of analytical activities related to supply chain. The Army, in particular, very focused on kind of the human supply chain of how do we attract people to enlist in the first place and who's most likely to stay with us over time so we can kind of focus our efforts on keeping the people in who we think have a good chance of doing that. But all sorts of opportunities, I think, but still early days.
Professor Davenport outlines the Delta model for assessing analytic capability within the public sector.
D is for data. As you suggested earlier, Michael, you got to have good data. And we found that when companies compete on analytics, they tend to view analytics as an enterprise, not as a bunch of little localized silos. So that's combining data, that's combining analytical people in many cases, and also combining, you know, technology and technology solutions. L in the Delta model is for leadership, probably the single most important thing. So, you know, if you've got somebody leading the charge, you'll do very well. In government, I think the best example of that is when Dr. Ken Kaiser was head of the VA, really led the charge on putting electronic medical records in place and starting to do things like disease management and so on with that data. T is for target. So where's your focus? focus for the VA. It's probably going to be on something involving patient care. For the Postal Service, it's probably going to be around something related to logistics as a primary target, because that's where you spend all your money and that's what creates your performance. Finally, A is for analysts. But you need some people who are able to think analytically, who can do the data analysis for you, and even more important, who can communicate effectively with decision makers about what the numbers say.
Tom Davenport offers the following advice to government agencies on how to leverage the right amount of analytics.
Well, if you look at the Delta model, Michael, I think the D is not a problem. The E is an issue in government, because we tend to be pretty fragmented in most agencies. The analytical people aren't talking to each other. The L word is probably the biggest problem, in that we don't have enough highly analytical leaders in government who are able to really press for this and devote the resources to it and so on. So I'm hoping that somehow they will emerge fairly soon. Targets thing is not that tough. I think for most government agencies, they can figure out, you know, where are the most fruitful targets. Finally, the A word for analysts, in a way, it's a problem because there aren't that many in government. Less of a problem because you can fairly easily procure them externally. I'm not sure that enough of that serious analytical work actually gets used in analyst reports, and even less so in policymaker decision making. So at the start of the funnel, we do really well. At the end of the funnel, where it comes to analysts and decision makers, not so well.
Professor Davenport also outlines a framework for improving decision making.
It's a 4I framework. It's not like Delta. It's not an acronym. But the first I is really to identify what are your key decisions. I mean, when I go around and talk to organizations, I say, you know, do you know what your top 10 or top 15 or top 20 decisions are? And very few do. And, you know, I think we can't make all of them better. So we should identify which ones, both a strategic perspective and an operational perspective, which ones are really critical to our effective performance. So then for those, you start taking a look at them. And I call that the inventory stage. So how well are they made today on average? How long do they take? Who's involved in them? You know, get a sense of how broken they are, how much opportunity there is for improvement, if you will. And then the third stage is to intervene in them. And maybe the difficult thing these days is there are a lot of possible interventions that most organizations haven't taken advantage of. You know, one being, if we're going to do a lot of that particular decision, we can automate it to some degrees. And that's one of the things that the Social Security Administration is doing with regard to disability claims. If it seems like a clear, open and shut case that a person has a disability and we want to get it through the system very quickly, might as well make that decision in an automated or at least a semi-automated fashion so you can get it done. I think IBM has been working with them on that particular project. Another would be just to think about who's involved in the decision and should it be a little bit broader. One of the things the Obama administration is trying to do is to get more, you know, public input into decision making. Another would be thinking about, you know, the mix of emotion and intuition and rationality in it. So there's some decisions like moral decisions that emotion seems to be absolutely essential to. If people lose the emotional part of their brain, they can't make those decisions at all. Whereas other decisions for which there's data available and for which, you know, the stakes are high really probably should not be purely intuition based. So the intervention step is really stepping back and saying, what can we do to make this decision better? And then finally, there's an institutionalization process to say, okay, if we really care about making decisions better, what are the things we can put in place, like a set of decision analysts or coaches, like a process for looking back at how decisions turn out, that could really make us get better at this over the long run?
Next up, Professor Karen Hardy introduces the concept of enterprise risk management. This is especially timely given the Obama administration's focus on accountability and transparency that has prompted a renewed focus on risks and controls.
Well, actually, you know, there are several definitions out there to define enterprise risk management. It's somewhat rather cryptic, to be quite honest with you. But at the end of the day, enterprise risk management is pretty much the process by which the management of risk within an organization are not just confined to a specific area or discipline like information technology or human resources, but these risks are raised to the executive level within an organization so that the nature and impact of those risks can be considered in a